Yeah, you know the drill. You know the
drill. That was sudden.
Yeah, you know. Why waste time? Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood.
Welcome back to Make Me Smart. I am back, actually, after a week off because I hurt my back and I'm a creaky old man. But other than that, also a cranky old man, but that's a whole different thing. Tech, economics, culture, we do all that stuff here. And this week, actually, you know, we're doing all three, right?
We are doing all three in the form of something we are calling the Content Wars.
Oh, my God. Are we saying it just like that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I should have mentioned this in the pre-show that every time we say it, you're going to have to say it just like that.
So, in a time when?
It's a rule.
Yeah.
It's not my rule. It's just a rule.
Don LaFontaine.
It turns out that tech and entertainment in particular are basically all coming from the same places these days. The tech companies are making the streaming services. The cable companies, which used to, you know, be the entertainment services, are now reduced to providing the pipes for the streaming services that are coming from the tech companies. It's gotten a little messy.
It is extremely messy. It's also, you know, expensive. They want your eyeballs and your money. Apple, Disney, NBC, Netflix. I think it's Viacom CBS now is the new one, right? Or CBS Viacom? No, I think it's Viacom CBS, right?
After the merger. They won.
Facebook as well. It is just not cheap out there.
Yeah. And so, in fact, before we dig into the discussion and get to our guests, we want to get an idea of people, how people are feeling about the cost, because I think the streaming fatigue is real. Producer Sharon Morris asked a few people in downtown LA how they're watching these days.
So what TV streaming services do you pay for right now?
Netflix. I just like the variety of shows they have on.
How many would you be willing to actually pay for?
Maybe two. I don't think I would pay for more than two because it can get a little pricey. So two is probably my max.
Well, we watch Amazon Prime a lot, movies and series. So we watch that more than we watch regular TV, Xfinity. I follow the trend, like our friends. If they actually comment that it is good and say they use it, then we might try it.
What do you mean, like Netflix and stuff? I think only Netflix. I do have Amazon. I forgot about that. But I do have Amazon, but I don't use either. I just continue to pay and I don't use it. Really? And I may even cancel Netflix and Amazon now because you reminded me. So.
There you go. Public service journalism right there. We saved that lady, what, $129 a year plus $12.99 a month for Netflix. Come on. That's
no
value
joke.
Right there. Contribute to public
radio. She should really donate to Marketplace,
I was just going to say. Oh, my God. So here are the names. Alexis Hentz from Illinois. Chris Xavier from San Francisco. Also, Shireen Behrouz from Los Angeles. They did not even bring up, by the way, Disney Plus or HBO Max or any of those other ones because there's more out there.
I know. I mean, I'm listening to this list and I am embarrassed. Yeah. Like, I'm paying for a lot of things. We're going to get to that in a minute. It does feel like...
You know what I discovered I'm still paying for, by the way? Fortnite. What? I need to cancel that. My wife's all over me to cancel that.
Oh.
I signed up to the kids to play Fortnite when she was out of town 1 week. And I ever since, she's been like, you got to cancel the Fortnite. I'm like, all right, anyway, I will.
I'm still paying for Xbox Live.
Yeah.
The Xbox isn't even plugged in. Oh, I know. One of the most popular videos I ever did at my previous employer was like a digital audit of all of the different things that people pay for, whether you realize or not. It's
you
a lot.
Do that. Do it again.
It does feel like, particularly with these services, because you hear people saying, I don't want to pay for more than two.
Right.
I'm paying for like seven. It's getting a little exhausting. And it also feels like the competition now is so real and content so expensive that there's going to be a Hunger Games type shakeout. Or we're going to run back to cable. We're going to be like, God, wouldn't it be nice if there was one service I could pay for that just included everything I want to watch? Where have I heard that before?
Because, by the way, they're about that expensive. Anyway, so to help us figure it out, we got Alex Sherman on the line. He is a media and technology reporter for CNBC. He is, I think, in our studio in New York. Right, Alex? How are you?
That's right. In your lovely studio in New York.
There you are. Which one? You in the big one or the small one?
I don't know. The one that I've been placed in. Is this the big one or the small one?
There you go.
This is the small one.
Small one. Yeah, you'd know if it was the big one. Well, look, thanks so much for coming on.
A pleasure to be here.
Alex, how many services are you paying for?
So, I was thinking about it as you were talking here. And the thing is, so I guess I pay for two right now, but I also pay, as I would imagine some of the people that you spoke with for the piece, for traditional pay TV, which, believe it or not, still 90 million American U.S. households about that pay for, your bundle of cable TV and Netflix and Amazon Prime Video largely serve as sort of add-ins to that. Now, that very well may change that dynamic over the next few years, because if you think the streaming fatigue is bad now, wait until 12 months from now, because you're about to be hit with a storm of these big products, many of which are not even out yet.
So do you think we're at a turning point? I mean, we've all been so used to Netflix for so long and then a little bit of Amazon Prime. But now, specifically Disney and Apple, right, are the big ones making the push. Are we at that inflection point, do you think?
Yeah, there's no question we are at. This is the beginning of a turning point. And even the companies that have resisted this turning point, which are mainly the large entertainment companies that have been making billions of dollars from the traditional cable TV model over the past 30 years. Even these guys, so we're talking about Disney, Time Warner, which is now owned by AT&T, NBC Universal, which is owned by Comcast, they make up a large portion of your current cable TV model, because NBC is NBC Universal, so that they own cable channels like Bravo and USA, et cetera. Even these guys have basically said, you know what? We see the writing on the wall here. We will allow consumers now to deconstruct your cable bundle, if you wish, cancel out video service, and then piece together these various different streaming services. So NBC service will come out in the beginning of 2020. Time Warner's, which is now Warner Media, their streaming service, which is being called HBO Max, will come out in the beginning of 2020. And then Disney Plus comes out in November of this year.
Well, and it's so interesting because you have these what were traditionally cable companies, right? You've got Comcast, which now owns the content. You have AT&T, which now owns the content. Like, it's those vertical mergers have actually allowed, it seems like, these companies to do the thing they feared the most, which is just be the delivery mechanism for the content. Like, they don't have to charge me for the TV anymore.
There's two very important dynamics to understand about why this is happening now. The first one has to do with, well, they really both have to do with the cost of traditional cable, but in two different ways. So the first thing to think about is, let's say your cable bill costs about $80 to $100. That is the average price for cable. That seems to be the uppermost point now, where we have finally seen several years of mass defections away from cable. In other words, the pay TV companies have basically come to the realization that consumers, by and large, are unwilling to pay more than $80 to $100 for their bundle of services. And since they have been canceling now in droves, cable companies, meaning Comcast, DirecTV, what was Time Warner Cable for years, now is Charter, these companies have come to understand that actually they can't keep passing on the costs to consumers. And instead, they make a much higher margin. It's sort of a much better financial product for them to sell broadband service. Now, DirecTV was bought by AT&T, so in that case, they're offering you now wireless service. But the mobile broadband service, or broadband to your house, has become a much better financial product because the margin is much greater. If you think about it, once you build the network, for every individual person you add to this network, the margins are huge. But for TV, because there's so much cost associated with buying up all the different channels and paying out all this money to Disney and Warner Media, et cetera, the margin on that product is not as good. So that's one dynamic. The second dynamic is Netflix. Wall Street has valued Netflix at a much higher multiple. It's sort of, you know, Wall Street jargony for how expensive is this company? How much do we think this company can grow? The multiple on Netflix is way, way, way higher than it is on all these legacy media companies. And the legacy media companies want that multiple to grow so that their stock price will go up and everyone will be happy and the executives will be compensated more, yada, yada, yada. So they are now trying to emulate the Netflix model because Wall Street has deemed Netflix the winner.
All right, so I've got a whole bunch of questions, but I want you to go back. Well, I'm going to take you back to that analysis you did 45 seconds ago of all the options and choices out there. And the word I want to throw at you is consumer fatigue. I just want to turn on my damn TV, man. Right?
Right. Well, if you want to turn on your damn TV, you probably, this is, gets back to the point of like, all right, so what am I getting here that I'm not getting for just paying $80 a month for cable? So you do get some things. So you get the ability to watch whatever programming you're buying anywhere you are on any device you are. And for many years, this has not been the case, and in fact continues not to be the case, with just paying your traditional $80 to your regional cable provider. Mm-hmm. If I'm paying, say, even my own parent company at CNBC, Comcast, if I'm just paying them money, I may be able to watch some shows in the house, not everywhere, because it's still a regional company. If you pay for one of these new streaming services, they are global, by and large. They are mobile. So you are getting more ease of use there. And of course, you're also getting the ability to pick and choose which ones you want based on what you actually want. So if I'm paying $80 a month, but I never watch ESPN, too bad. Mm-hmm. I'm getting ESPN. Now I can at least pay less money and only get what I want. So you have to balance this idea of consumer fatigue against actual consumer utility, of which there is some here with this new model of how to actually watch video.
I'm going to interject here. Am I the only cord cutter in this conversation?
Yeah, that's so interesting. I was going to say, because there's also that, right? You have to get, you have to expend the energy. Yes, you are. Alex probably has already cut the cord. I don't know.
No, you said you pay for pay TV.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You're right.
Well, so I was a cord cutter. And full disclosure, though, once I joined CNBC, I was at Bloomberg for 10 years. When Comcast became my parent company, they offer you an employee discount. So it then became useful again for me to be a cable TV. And look, I am a media reporter, and I still cut the cord.
Yeah.
So look, it is real.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to go ahead and represent the fatigue. I'm going to give you the list because I referred to it earlier, but I've been writing it down as we talk. So I pay for YouTube TV as a cable replacement.
Yeah.
I pay for Netflix.
Yeah.
I pay for Prime, which I would pay for anyway.
Yeah.
I pay for Hulu. And then I pay for HBO. And then here is actually the benefit. I really want to watch. I love this show called Strike Back on Cinemax. Don't judge me. It's an awesome, ridiculous action show.
Okay.
So then I pay when Strike Back comes out, when there's a new season, I pay for Cinemax for as long as it takes me to watch that show, and then I cancel it.
Right.
And so, I do have that flexibility to pick up something and drop. I'm going to pay for CBS All Access because I should catch up on that new Star Trek thing. And so I'm at 7 or 8 things. I'm still paying less than all in than cable. But now Disney Plus is coming. Do I need to pay for that? Like, it is, you start to wonder, could Comcast come along and cut a deal with Hulu or Netflix to offer it as part of the thing? And then you could just have the one service to rule them. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I like it, but I hate it.
We're headed in that direction. So a couple things based on that. Number one, there is no term for this yet, but I would classify you as not a true cord cutter in a sense because of the YouTube TV. So if you subscribe to YouTube TV, you are in essence getting cable. Like, that is a bundle that you're paying $40 or $50 a month for. That is not one of these traditional, or not traditional, but new streaming services that are like Disney Plus, which is going to be $6.99 a month. So that's a big difference there, I think, and allows you to watch a lot more programming that you might not be able to if you're just buying a few of these streaming services. Second point is that actually, even today, if you buy traditional cable from Comcast, your Netflix, you still need to sign up for Netflix, but at least you get your Netflix on that Xfinity set-top box that you get. So if I use that remote control and I say some Netflix show into the remote by my voice-controlled remote, I will actually see that Netflix show appear on my Comcast cable box. So the integration is slowly coming together, but the big question here still remains, is there going to be one company, whether it's Apple or Roku or something else, that comes along and aggregates all of these streaming services for a discount? That does not exist today. And I think that may be where we're headed, and that looks an awful lot like cable.
back to the future, as it were. You just mentioned Apple for, I think, the first time in this conversation. We've been going, 10-ish minutes. Apple TV has been like, and yes, there already is, so Apple Plus or whatever it's being called now, this new launch that they're doing, it's been like the holy grail of on-demand streaming, and yet they've done bupkis.
Yeah, and they've done bupkis for 10 years running now. Yeah. People that are real Apple watchers might remember when Walter Isaacson's Steve Jobs documentary was released, which was shortly after his death. There was a line in there that Steve Jobs said he had cracked the code on television, but there was no explanation on what that was exactly. And whatever it was, real or not, it did not come to fruition. So Apple has bobbled along, trying to struggle, figuring out some way where their sort of brand and MO is to be this innovative company, this truly different experience from a user interface technology standpoint. it still does not exist. And what we're actually seeing from Apple right now is sort of they're playing catch up and copy rather than innovating. Right. So Apple will come out with this new streaming service called Apple TV Plus. They have not announced a price. They have not announced a date. There has been some reporting that maybe it will be later this year. Maybe it will be $10 a month. But it will be for just a small sampling of shows. So again, when you put Apple TV Plus in the list of the streaming services you just mentioned, I'm going to pay $10 a month for that, but maybe I'm already paying, you know, $15 a month for HBO, which has a decades-long catalog of shows, and Netflix is costing me even less than that, and I'm getting so much for Netflix. Does it really make sense for me to pay $10 for this Apple bundle where I don't know what I'm getting, and it doesn't have any library? There's no back content. I can't watch Friends, you know, because it doesn't have Friends. It didn't pay for Friends.
Which, by the way, costs like $500 million if you want to have it on
It does, because a lot of people still watch Friends. It was really, really well watched on Netflix.
I know.
That's because all the kids these days are about a 90s revival. Okay, but this conversation gets to, I think, the crux of why Apple has not succeeded, why cable still has the annoying limitations that cause me to prefer YouTube TV to Comcast, and that is licensing, right? Like, that is these publishers saying, I mean, I remember when I worked for the parent company of CBS, these conversations about how they would slice and dice the definition of devices, like that streaming on a phone is different from streaming on a tablet, is different from streaming on a laptop, and NBC is over here, and Apple maybe couldn't get the deals with the content publishers because they were so burned by the music industry. Like, doesn't this at some point all come down to a CBS or a publisher being willing to say, okay, Comcast, you can offer a service that anybody can stream anywhere, and it's going to include every show?
Absolutely. And sort of the slicing and dicing of the rights here has so many different implications here, because there's a data play associated with the licensing. Like, do you get the information if you're just licensing a show about who exactly is watching? And if I'm only getting the digital rights for that, I'm obviously paying less. But if so, some companies want to get the exclusive rights for it, where they have all of the various distribution on it, so that Seinfeld isn't just available, you know, today it's available on Hulu and it's available on TBS or whatever station you're getting from syndication. So what we're seeing, and this is new sort of frontier territory, and we still don't know how it will play out, is that the media companies that actually produce the shows, so we're talking about the studios now that are actually owned within these broader media companies. So Comcast owns Universal, and AT&T, which bought Warner Media, owns Warner Brothers. These producers actually sort of have the upper hand on buying back the shows if they want them. So this HBO Max product that's coming out in the beginning of 2020, it's not just going to have HBO, but what we're seeing is sort of the take back of the shows where content companies have previously sold these shows to the highest bidder. Now what they're doing is they're saying, you know what, I'm going to be the highest bidder because I don't want you spending your $15 on Netflix anymore, where we've licensed this show out to Netflix for years. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take this back for me. I'm going to, in essence, pay myself the most money, but that way we can get your extra dollar at HBO, at AT&T. So if you have a choice between watching Netflix and watching HBO Max, we're going to take back Friends, which we made, and we're going to make that as part of our service and stop selling it to other services, which will theoretically weaken services like Netflix that have not have the library of these shows from the 80s and 90s, et cetera.
So it's all a sort of a sort of mutually cannibalizing process going after the same, you know, big but fundamentally limited set of eyeballs.
That's exactly right. That's why this is you named this section the content wars.
Right, right. Okay, so just as a way to wrap this up, because we could legit go all day on this thing. You started with, we're at the beginning of that turn. We're at the beginning of that pivot. What does the pivot look like when we're done?
So here's my best guess. My guess is that you'll actually see traditional pay TV exist. It will become a more niche product for wealthier people. The pay TV providers will stop pushing back so hard at the rising cost of the bundle, in essence, and they will make this traditional pay TV service a more luxury service geared toward people who, think of it as a university grant system. There's a group of people out there where they're like, eh, just I'll pay what it is. Just give it to me. Like, I'm too lazy to piece together this thing. So just give me what I need to do and I'll pay a premium for that luxury. That's what that ends up being. And then the rest of the world actually picks and chooses or waits for some sort of aggregator to come along to say, here are the four or five streaming services that I'm willing to pay for before I get to that $60, $80 mark, whatever it is, that people are just sort of programmed to not be willing to spend more for. And then the ones that don't survive, the ones that don't get picked up enough for Wall Street to say that they are the winners, they will just continue to merge with each other unless regulators step in. So you saw Viacom, CBS come together last week. You know, the Discoveries out there, the Lionsgates, the MGMs, the AMCs, these smaller media companies that may not have the heft to offer up their own streaming service that is one of the winners, expect them to just keep merging with each other until they get the scale where they become one of those winners.
Alex Sherman is a media and tech reporter for CNBC. Alex, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good stuff, Alex. Thanks, man.
Yep.
Wow.
Fascinating. Probably do that all day. Boy, you got to think that long term, Apple and Netflix actually end up being at the biggest disadvantage, because we didn't get to this because we could have gone on all day, but content creation is super expensive.
Super expensive.
Like, there are reports that Apple is spending $6 billion to make really just a handful of new shows with no library to back it up. That's that's a problem. And that's a bad business.
They're going to wind up licensing. And you got to wonder how much of that $250 billion that Tim Cook has in the bank he's willing to spend on this enterprise.
On just like TV.
TV. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you gonna buy it? Are you gonna watch that Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston morning television show thing?
No, that doesn't interest me at all. I only like stupid action stupid, stuff. I'm like, my biggest problem with Disney Plus, which sounds like the greatest service on earth. Like, I'm sorry, I know America's only going to end up with one company, and it's going to be Disney. Is it doesn't include FX, and that's where all the awesome action shows are.
Avengers, Marvel. You're a fan.
I mean, fine, but I've already watched those like 30 times. I mean, I'm going to get that too. But if it had FX, I'd be like, take all my money, $20 a month. Okay.
All right.
Anyway, we would like to know your thoughts now. That's what I'm going to do. That's my consumer plan. But tell us, can you just not wait to add another subscription to pay each month? I mean, look, we're all going to do it for Picard, right? On CBS All Access?
I don't believe we are, no.
My fellow nerds? Anyone? Send us a voice memo or an email.
Somebody help me smart.
Help me out. Back me up here. Make me smart at marketplace.org.
I'm taking a break. Back in a minute.
Welcome back to the show. Some exciting news. We have some exciting news in the picks today.
We do? Oh, we do. I mean, yes, we do. We do. Sorry. I didn't know what you were talking about.
I peeked ahead. I peeked ahead.
Also, could I just say you changed yours?
I did change mine,
what
yes.
What?
Because, you know, I was trying to be really responsible and I picked mine like days ago.
That.
Like, oh, I really want to talk about this and I'm all excited.
And now you didn't anymore?
But then, I'm a fickle creature.
All right, I'm going to leave that there.
I still want to talk about that other thing eventually, but not today. Today I want to talk about, I have another question.
The other thing is the inverted yield curve, just saying.
It's modern monetary
theory. Oh, modern monetary theory. Which
I think just became a musical. But because, now we're doing it. Okay, here's the thing. I read this article that essentially said that even if President Trump panics and wants to undo the trade war and make friends with Xi Jinping, that China is now, after a year of trade war, in a much stronger position because they've already absorbed a bunch of the body blows from the trade war. And also that China is in a position to practice modern monetary theory by basically like making as much money as they want. And then I wanted you to explain modern monetary theory.
So very briefly, and I'm going to do this in like 15 seconds or less. Modern monetary theory says if you control your own currency, which the United States does as opposed to, say, Eurozone countries, right? If you control your own currency, budget deficits don't matter. Almost nothing matters because you can print as much money as you want. And then it's incumbent upon the Congress to raise or lower taxes to take care of that inflation risk. Modern monetary theory is very interesting. It's also very complicated and a long shot. And we'll discuss this at a future date. That was like 20 seconds.
Great.
Sorry.
Okay. Awesome.
But that wasn't your thing. What's your thing?
I knew you could do that in 20 seconds. Okay, no. But then the thing that I became way more obsessed with is the WeWork IPO.
Oh, my God. Right? Are you kidding me? Who's going to buy shares in that company? I mean, consult your own financial advisor, but holy cow.
But here is the crazy thing. So I don't know if you guys followed this, but WeWork's prospectus, its IPO, its S1 filing, is like the craziest thing ever. It revealed, among other things, that WeWork CEO Adam Neumann came up with the idea for like the We company, and then sold it to, like trademarked We, and then sold it to his own company for almost $6 million.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my favorite part.
Like, that is probably the best part, but then there are a whole other string of crazy things, not to mention the fact that everything about the fundamentals of the business is completely obscured. And in fact, there's this analyst from Triton Research who's quoted in Bloomberg today as saying that the prospectus is a, quote, masterpiece of obfuscation.
Yeah.
Because it tells nothing about the business, seemingly on purpose. But here is my question.
Yes.
What is the role of the SEC here? Like, can't they just say, you know what? This is banana pants and you can't go public. You cannot be part of the public markets.
I'm going to go on Edgar and look for banana pants. Edgar is a SEC tracking service. So the SEC's role is to make sure that it's all legal and in accordance with regulations. There is sadly no banana pants requirement.
And well, so there should be.
Yes, but WeWork's got itself some very smart lawyers, some securities lawyers.
Unbelievable.
And crafted it to fit within the law.
I mean, pension funds could end up invested in this thing.
Yes.
Like, that does not seem like something the SEC should. I demand a banana pants rule.
Somebody put that on the t-shirt. I demand a banana pants rule.
I'm going to get myself appointed to the SEC, and I'm going to push for the banana pants rule. Like, no, this is just a hard pass for the public market.
Yeah.
You should go read it. It's fascinating.
It's craziness. Truly it is. Truly it is. Yes. But the good news is that corporate America has decided it's going to do some social good. That's my thing. I know, right?
I know. So I'm so glad that this is your thing.
The Business Roundtable, which is a very large business lobbying group led by maybe the biggest of the big, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, came out the other day with a restatement, and this is a quote, of the purpose of a corporation. And it turns out that the purpose of a corporation, for the first time in like 40 umpty years, is no longer to just maximize shareholder profits, right? Yes, you got to make shareholders some money, but the Business Roundtable, the 181 signatories, and Jamie Dimon himself came out the other day and said, look, you need to take into account the workers and the environment and social good and all of those other things that a lot of people who say capitalism is broken have been talking about. And I, frankly, Ms. Wood, I'm surprised that that was not your thing, because we've been talking about this for a long time.
Oh, it would have been my thing. Oh, if I hadn't already seen it in the you did. Well, and I'm glad, because either way, this was coming to the show. Now, I mean, this is like the thing we've been talking about for 2 years. Yeah. So the question is, do you buy it?
No. Do you buy it? Do you buy it?
I want to buy it.
I know you want to buy it. Do you buy it?
Okay. I don't buy it as stated.
Uh-huh.
But I buy a version of it. I buy the business need for the change.
Yes. Yes.
If that makes sense.
No, totally, right? Because it is increasingly important as this economy changes and as so many things in this society change that corporations change, because consumers will fundamentally demand it. I just don't think it's going to be as pretty and tied up in a neat little bow with a neat little bow as the Business Roundtable would have it be. You know?
Right. Because I agree.
How do you tell shareholders that they are no longer the most important thing and then expect them to continue to buy your stock? Right.
I mean, I guess you're hoping for new shareholders.
They are. But you know what? Capitalism doesn't care if you live or die, pal.
I have heard multiple.
There we go. It took you long enough. God, I was waiting for it. I even gave you like the pregnant pause a minute ago.
I guess they just wanted you to go even darker.
I know, right? Look,
they wanted to just take us all the way there.
I think it's a huge step forward. I have my doubts. That's it. That's what
I mean, I have my doubts. And clearly everybody is like cynical about the institutions. But I've heard multiple interpretations and given my own that suggest that, look, this is just what you're going to have to. This is good for business at this point.
Yeah.
And it comes down. It's about hiring. Like, you're not going to be able to hire employees who care about these values if you don't espouse some version of them. But it's also about continuing to create a consumer class that can afford your products.
It's Henry Ford and paying his workers $5 a day so that they could buy the Model T. It's not a new concept.
At the end of the day.
It's not a new concept, but somewhere in the middle of the 20th century, corporate America went off the rails and said the most important thing, thank you very much, Milton Friedman, is to maximize shareholder value. And maybe now here early in the 21st, we're seeing that that's not the case. Anywho.
Right. It'll be I agree with you. It's a long road back if we actually get on that road, but it's a start.
So send us your thoughts, actually, about whether or not you think this is real or if I'm just being a downer or whatever. Make me smart, marketplace.org, voice memo on your phone. Email it to us. We'll put it on the show.
Yep. Bring it on.
Like with all these people.
And in fact, on that note,
yes,
more of you.
Yes.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Yay. Okay.
Yay.
That's what we're
going to
do.
Last week, in fact, we are going to do that. Last week, because this hits on, businesses and their ethical treatment of you and your data. We talked about all these gradations,
yes,
the strata of privacy, and how your definition of privacy might actually not match up to what Facebook means when they say privacy these days. John Wee is a lecturer on social media policy and marketing at UC Irvine, who we should probably interview. Source list. And he said the episode gave him a lot to think about.
It made me think of my recent Gen Z students in the past couple years and their ignorance and ambivalence when it comes to privacy concerns stemming from social media platforms. The students were also not really swayed to be more aware and only really became concerned when learning about the extreme scenarios like the social credit system in China.
Mm-hmm. Social credit, which I think we have talked about, right? Didn't we talk about that at some point?
We have, yeah. And it's in a Black Mirror episode. Now there is, I mean, to be fair, there is some growing body of evidence that Gen Zers are starting to, I mean, they are, for example, they're the reason in a large way that Facebook wants to pivot to messaging, because that's what they're doing. They have really stopped sort of like broadcasting to everyone and started to favor kind of like group chat as their preferred method of communication, which is a little bit more private. They're not that aware of the value of their personal data yet necessarily,
right,
but
I
they are starting to realize that kind of, but who is? I mean, all of us are just now starting to be like, oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
That seems useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Parker Lumpkiss from Dallas, Texas, had this to say about privacy.
One of the biggest things that caught my ear is my data can go toward more malicious ends that may be enabling something that I'm very personally opposed to. So I feel like I don't want my lingering on a website page to train a machine learning algorithm to discriminate against people, for example.
Which makes sense.
Yes.
But yeah, you know.
But you can't necessarily stop it. Spoiler alert. This is essentially the topic of my column that will be coming out later this week in Wired.
Oh, there you go.
In the idea section about how, like the data, the need for data, the great sucking maw of data is not going anywhere because we're training the machines and we have to start really planning for the worst possible uses. Basically.
But look, if you don't want to train them, here's the problem. You're going to go online and look for stuff either that you're interested in or that you're curious about because you heard about it. And even though it might not be your thing, you want to learn more about it. And the computer doesn't, the algorithm thing, he says, in a technical sense, doesn't care which of the motivations they are, right? It doesn't know your motivation. It just knows what you're clicking on. And it will take that data and build on it. That's the catch, he says, about the algorithm thing. Yeah.
The algorithm the ones in the O's and the whatnot.
I was talking to my mother the other day, and we had her on speakerphone. Yeah. And my mom, as I think I've said before on this program, is not the most technologically advanced woman. Had her on speakerphone, and my 17-year-old said something snarky about me on Twitter, and he was like, "Grandma, you ought to see what he does on Twitter." And my mother said, "I don't need another machine in my life, Kai. I'm just not doing that." And I'm like, "Mom, it's not a machine."
But she's not wrong, though. She's not wrong.
I know.
It is. It's a learning machine.
Yes.
You're right, Kai's mom.
Yes.
I hope you're listening, even
she's
though
not.
He says you're not.
She's not. And we're never
getting
her on
Twitter.
All right,
2 weeks ago, we did our Economics of Inequality episode on racial inequality, and Sandra Bond from Newport, Oregon, sent us this voice memo with her idea to help close this particular inequality gap.
I'd like to see a systemic inequality tax rate adjustment where people's taxes are reduced in proportion to their income loss from systemic inequality.
I admire the motivation. I think the methodology
That's amazing. It is
amazing. And, the motivation is great. I think what you got to do is not worry about taxes on the lower end. Yes, earn income tax credit and reduce taxes on people who proportionally don't have a lot of income. But if you really want to do that, if you want to do an income adjustment via the tax code, you got to tax the rich people a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. That's because why? Because that's where the money is.
Right. So it can't be you reduce.
Right.
Taxes in proportion to your income loss, but you increase taxes in proportion to the income gained by not essentially earning.
That is correct.
Due to systemic inequality.
That's where the money is, and there's a lot of it.
You know, one thing actually that you, Kai, brought up during that interview 2 weeks ago was that 400 years ago, it marks when slavery began in this country. And I just like want to shout out to the 1619 project that the New York Times has done and put. I mean, it is remarkable, and it essentially is making that point in the most painful of ways, that so many of the things that underlie essentially all the, I mean, the pieces make this argument that almost all of the things that make America exceptional originated with slavery. It is intense and amazing. I like one to take the day off and read all the,
For sure.
And if you can still find a Sunday copy, it's in the magazine.
Yeah, you know what's so funny? I literally did not know where in my town to buy a Sunday copy of the New York Times. I tried three places. They didn't have it. So I read it online. I did not get a hard copy, and it bums me out.
I don't have one either, and I saw a video of a guy who had driven like all over his town to find it, and then he was like, I bought two copies, and I can't believe this is happening. And it was like, it made me tear up a little bit. It's pretty remarkable.
Yes, 1619 Project, New York Times. Check it out. Make Me Smart question is where we go now. Something you thought you knew, but you found out you were wrong about. School, as we all know, is starting back up again around the country. My kids have been in school for like a week already. Hello. So we asked a college student the Make Me Smart question this week. Not your average college student, though. Amanda Gorman is the first National Youth Poet Laureate in the United States, about to start her senior year at Harvard. Here's what she said.
Something that I thought I knew, but I actually learned more about, was I actually always thought of Frederick Douglass as this figure for literature and words and the power of understanding language, basically. And it wasn't until I dug further into his history that I actually discovered that Frederick Douglass was the most photographed man of his time. Frederick Douglass was very intentional with the photographs he took. It wasn't random that this man who had actually been born a slave ended up taking more photos than the president of the United States. He made sure to sit down for so many photographs because he understood he could serve as a counter image to the stereotype that had been created about Black Americans at the time. So, for example, if you look at his photographs, he's never smiling. It was because Frederick Douglass was very intentional with rejecting the idea of the happy, jolly, merry slave. And how I internalized that in my own poetry, how can I be intentional with the imagery that my language is creating? And how can I use that to counteract stereotypes? In my own life as a Black woman, I found that people often place me in the archetype of the angry Black woman, which is why I so purposefully write poems that are instead about hope, so that I can directly challenge that stereotype that Black women are just wedded to fury.
1619 Project, New York Times. Read that whole thing, right? That
was accidental narrative arc, everyone. Yeah. That is remarkable. Yep. And I did not know any of that about Frederick Douglass. That is fascinating. And the phrase wedded to fury could only come from the National Youth Poet Laureate. Yeah. Like, that is just beautiful.
Yeah.
See, this is the best part of the show, guys. Please do the same thing. What is your answer to the Make Me Smart question? Send us a voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org because you blow our minds every week. And so we can give a little back, remember to subscribe to the Make Me Smart newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters, where we try to have information even half this interesting. No, it's a really good newsletter.
Yeah, it's good. It totally is.
Check it out.
And with that, the close music. Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. The senior producer is Eve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Summer Dunsmore. I think Summer's off today, though. I don't know. I mean, I give Ben a hard time when he's off, so, you know, I might as well share the wealth, as it were.
Way to land on the beat, though. That was nice. This week's program, you know, yeah, he's let's try. Yeah. He's got some musical chops in there.
Trained radio professional.
This week's program was engineered, I hope, by Drew Jostad, because I can't see him. Thank you also to Sarah Bruguer in our New York Bureau for wrangling our guest. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager who listens more than Kai's mom is Deborah Clark.
Of course, that's not saying much. I mean, you know.
I know. I mean, I'm not saying this every week. I'm just saying.
Just, you know, this week.
Probably. Hi. Hi, boss. Hey, Alex, I heard you say you had a liter of vodka for breakfast, and so we're already besties. Me too. What a coincidence.
Glad to hear you did as well.
I mean, you freaking people.
It's going to be a great show.
Jesus.
You got to get amped somehow.
I had coffee. I had a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Was it that coffee with the bourbon in it? Just wondering.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.